Top 100 Project
and action.
Good day, podcast aficionados, and thank you for checking out the T100P, the spoiler-laden podcast that discusses the AFI's 1998 and 2007 lists of the 100 greatest American movies. I'm Ryan Ellis, with our panting dog Fox, and that expert charioteer, my wife Bev.
That's me.
Okay, the coming attractions trivia for this week's film, Ben-Hur. Charlton Heston had only this one AFI movie. How many of his far less famous co-stars were in more AFI films than him? 1, 2, 4, or 6?
Since I don't recognize any of the actors from any of the other films, although you're looking at me like I've completely forgotten somebody, and I probably have, I'm going to say 1.
There are 4. I counted 4. One of them you would recognize, Jack Hawkins. He had 3 AFI films, and one of them was Bridge on the River Kwai.
Oh, God, you said that when we were watching it.
Because he's Major Warden in that film. The other 3 people are Kathy O'Donnell, who had 2 films in total. She was Wilma in Best Years of Her Lives.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. Andre Morrell, who had 2, and Richard Hale, who had 2. So there's the 4 people. Charlton Heston, giant star, icon of the cinema, only 1 AFI film. All right, so movie number 57 in the Top 100 Project is Ben-Hur, and it was 72nd on the 1998 Top 100 list between Forrest Gump and another William Wyler film, Wuthering Heights. Then it took a near-record plunge, falling all the way to 100 in 2007, just ahead of newcomer Toy Story. Ben-Hur premiered in New York on November 18, 1959, then was released by MGM on November 24th. This was a make-or-break for MGM, and they made a lot of money when Ben-Hur was a monumental hit. Bev will describe the story for you with a skinny.
Jesus-era Jewish prince Judah Ben-Hur, played by Charlton Heston, is exiled into slavery by his former friend after a deceptive betrayal. Judah's journey finds him rowing in a slave ship, riding chariots in a deadly race, and eventually rediscovering his family and his humanity.
Or in a nutshell, shoddy roofing leads to forced rowing, skin disease, and equine trampling.
I have a nutshell, too.
Ooh, she's got her own. Let's do it. Hit it. Show it. Say it.
Slave-owning aristocrat is ruined by occupying forces. Through grit and faith, stages a years-long, unlikely comeback. And the only reason I wrote that is because it could very easily, even though it's accurate and specific, it could just as easily be the nutshell for Gone with the Wind.
Or Gladiator, although it's not in the AFI list.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Most of these ancient epics seem to be about revenge. Braveheart, Gladiator, yeah. Lawrence of Arabia, Spartacus, sometime or another in the story, their comeback is about, I'm going to make that guy pay.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got 3 of those 5 on the list, not Braveheart and not Gladiator. I called Gladiator Braveharticus, and I could have called it Ben-Huricus, I guess, too. I like how your nutshell mentions that he's a slave owner. That's never mentioned in the reviews. It's glossed over that he has slaves at the beginning of the film.
Well, I guess they did it for some reason. It was probably in the book, and there's some element of historical accuracy, but they just bend over backwards to make the audience forgive him for owning slaves.
He's a nice slave owner.
But he's so nice. And He just keeps saying over and over, I hotly consider you a slave. Yes, well, he is a slave.
Until you say, I do not consider you a slave, that's not a good enough sentence.
Yeah. Until I say, I free you.
And you no longer are a slave, which He does do for his eventual love interest. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. So what is your overall view of Ben-Hur?
The film is too long, and it's preachy, and it's full to the brim with relentless overkill and screaming out for a ruthless editor to come and trim an hour of screen time from its plethora of extra-long reaction shots and never-ending horse admiration. That said, there are enough meaty performances and captivating drama to make you overlook those flaws and get you to the notorious chariot race, which is still unparalleled in its perfection. Unfortunately, the film has the poor taste to continue going on for another hour and ruin it with that drawn-out leper story, but everything leading up to and including the chariot race, I really liked. I loved his dynamic with Masala. Maybe it doesn't hurt that there's 40 minutes where a young, fit Charlton Heston is soaking wet and wearing a loincloth, flexing his muscles. That probably didn't hurt.
Cut for 1959. We said this about Liam Holden on Bridge in the River Kwai.
Mm-hmm.
That for 1957 for that movie, 1959 for this one, these guys are like Adonises.
Yeah, I saw that Burt Lancaster was up for the part. Heston gives Lancaster a run for his money.
Yeah, which is saying something.
Yeah.
If these guys lived today and worked out like the guys today, they'd probably put a lot of those guys to shame.
Oh, yeah.
And you're right, he is half naked through a few moments, a lot of moments in this movie, as he often was in this film. So he always seemed to find a way to get his shirt off. Kind of like Shatner on Star Trek.
The other movie I really know him for always is Planet of the Apes. Also, lots of shirtless stuff.
Well, most movie for him, at least, he doesn't wear anything other than that loincloth thing they have on him. Fox has turned on my Judah Ben-Hur, too, because he's in the background just huffing and puffing over there. Ooh, he looks good. To comment on what you said, the movie's absolutely too long. And we're going to say about every movie that's 3+ hours, I think. Maybe not the ones that everybody likes so much, like The Godfathers. Pulp Fiction is 2.5 hours, which is pretty long. And Goodfellas is really long. All gangster films. But we'll see what we think when we get to those. Maybe we won't like the fact that they're so long either. This one does draw it out, and it is a film full of pregnant pauses and portentous reaction shots that makes it ripe for mockery, too.
Yeah.
Monty Python.
Yeah, that's true. I'm sure that Mystery Science Theater could just have a heyday with this. They'd have so much time to fill in with their commentary. I was thinking when we were watching the chariot race, which you wait for so long for it to finally get there, and then there's that long pageantry scene where the horses just walk around, and I'm sitting there watching that thinking, if this movie had a hockey game in it, he would film the entirety of the Zamboni pass. It's so overkill. It was unnecessary. Apparently he put that in because in all the close-ups and all the kinetic motion that's necessary to sell the action sequence, you didn't really get a good impression of what the arena looked like as a whole. But maybe you have one shot that lasts 10 seconds, not a sequence that lasts like 10 minutes, but it's probably a good solid 3 minutes. And that's after all the drawn out horses kind of getting in their places. And like I said, the horse admiration is...
horse porn.
Yeah, they really loved their horses.
That is the most famous scene in this movie, of course. It is about 2/3 or 3/4 of the way through the film. As you point out, it's not the end of the film. The leper story at the end is the most important thing to him. Because when he does beat Masala, Stephen Boyd plays him very well, I thought. We didn't mention...
I liked him.
We didn't say specifically who he was in the opening, but that is who plays him, Stephen Boyd. When Judah beats him in the chariot race, and then indirectly Masala dies, pretty much of his own making, by whipping Judah and then losing control of his chariot because he's too busy worried about what the other guy's doing and not just running the race. Maybe he would have won straight up if he hadn't been cheating so much. Yeah. Although I guess there's no cheating on the...
There are no rules.
Right. The only rule, no rules. Yeah. But he's like Batman. I've mentioned Batman a few times in our 1950s films, and Shane I did. But kind of like with Bruce Wayne, he doesn't seem to feel any sense of relief even when he gets his revenge. And so the leper story is his redemption. We talked about he gets his humanity back, and he gets his family back, and that's the most important thing to him. That's what this whole movie is about, and that's what it comes down to. But he also needs them to be saved, I guess, by Jesus and the promise of redemption.
Yeah, the thunderstorm comes and, I guess, washes away leprosy. I'm honestly not familiar enough with the Jesus story in the Bible to know if that comes from the Bible, the rainstorm thing.
You like that, though. You pointed out you thought that was an effective metaphor. That they show the blood running and they show the water.
I liked the Jesus stuff. It was just so much longer than it needed to be, and it felt like it was shoehorned in there. You almost wish it could have been a separate movie or something. There was something about it that just didn't work, didn't jive with the rest of the film. Initially, before the chariot race, BCR, they get that stuff in there, and it's not bad. It kind of works. And I think that they probably could have taken everything after the chariot race and cut it down to like 20 minutes, and they would have had this really beautiful sequence about his crucifixion. But instead, they have all this stuff with his mother and sister. Like, how can I go on sympathizing with somebody who exposes himself and hundreds of other unwitting people to leprosy? Dude, you found Jesus, so you hate violence again. That's rad. But you are cooler than ever with pestilence. And it's 40 minutes long and mostly just two women with their faces covered offering weak protest. It goes on and on and on.
The irony is the subtitle of this movie, as it was in the original movie, the 1925 silent version.
And the book.
And the book, A Tale of the Christ.
Yeah.
So it's occasionally about Jesus.
And it's a story about a guy who seeks out vengeance and gets it, and not just wins, but his mother and sister get cured of leprosy.
Yeah, he gets everything back.
It's not really very Christ-like. I'm not really criticizing that, but it is weird how it's supposed to be really about Christ, but it's not really about Christ. It's really about Ben-Hur, and they shoehorned Christ in there, which is a shame, because honestly, I did really like a lot of what they did with that.
Heston himself has said, it was, I think, the AFI special, that Judah Ben-Hur is not a hero. He's a survivor, which is an interesting take on this because, of course, he was nominated for the Heroes and Villains list, didn't make it. Stephen Boyd as Masala, nominated for the Villains list, didn't make it. Having seen the movie again for, I think, only the third time I've ever seen the movie, maybe the fourth, and I don't know if I've watched it since I bought the DVD in 2001. Pretty good looking print, incidentally, for a movie that's that old. Yeah. There's a Blu-ray out there, but we're going to pay the $50 for it is for that giant package they have. And not having seen the movie in so long, I don't remember most of it, but there were some things I hadn't. I forgot how long it takes to get to the main story. There's an awful lot of the Jesus stuff. I didn't remember seeing the very opening. You said that your professor who showed it to you in school skipped right past all of that.
It wasn't my professor. It was my teacher in high school. It was my history teacher. He just started, I think, when Masala comes to the city.
Okay, yeah.
And then,
when the story proper
actually happens. Yeah, when the story proper actually happens. And he ends it immediately after the chariot race. And he goes, well, the rest is boring. Which was accurate. And he probably also was doing that because he wouldn't be able to justify showing all of that Jesus story to a class full of public school kids in a diverse community. It just wouldn't have been cool. So he showed it for the historical aspect, which I guess he trusted has some kind of accuracy. I don't really remember. I think he really was just like, please watch this because the semester's almost over and I don't feel like teaching you.
You saw the teacher's cut then.
I saw the teacher's cut. I saw the public school
cutting
teacher's
cut. Cutting out probably a solid hour of material.
Yeah.
Whatever we thought of it, 87% of critics and 89% of audiences on Rotten Tomatoes are fans of the film. Mm-hmm. Those are pretty strong numbers. I was mildly surprised. This may be a bigger surprise. Although we knew it was a big hit, I said it was a make or break for MGM. And the reason why it was a make or break is they were going to go bankrupt. They were going to go bankrupt with or without Ben-Hur. And the idea was, well, let's take whatever we have left. We'll beg, borrow, and steal from the banks. Get whatever we possibly can. And if we lose, we were going to lose anyway. So then they made this enormous amount of money. Ah. They made so much money, and obviously films like this often get re-released, so the numbers are a little bit skewed. Modern movies usually get a run and then they're done.
How much money is it?
13th on Box Office Mojo and adjusted for inflation. And Heston's other big hit, The Ten Commandments, I think is 6th. And that's another movie we're going to compare to a little bit in this podcast, I'm sure. A movie that was certainly worthy in the sense of influence, success, popularity over time. I'm not a big fan of the movie. I've only seen that movie once at Easter, like everyone watches at Easter now, I think. But it's interesting that these two huge, epic, biblical movies, both starring the same guy, and William Wyler, who directed this, said he wanted to do a Cecil B. DeMille type of movie, and it was out of his element in doing it. It was not the kind of movie he had done before.
Yeah, he got a lot of criticism, even after the movie came out.
But especially for even trying it. I think it was more so before he started than after.
I read a Vintage review. I think it was the Variety review I read. They didn't like it. They were rolling their eyes at all of the excess in the film, the overkill, as I said before. Mm-hmm. And they pointed out, which we'll talk about later, that the chariot race, hands down best part of the film, was not directed by Wyler.
Yeah,
he oversaw it, but it was directed by his stunt coordinator.
Yakima Pinnock.
And another second unit director.
Sure. They had hands on with that, mostly because there's so many stunts. I definitely want to talk about that sequence, because it is the most famous thing, as you said. But there's a lot of little tidbits I want to get to first. So sure. I don't want to bury the lead. But just getting back to the Box Office Mojo thing, it is ahead of Avatar, adjusted for inflation. It's ahead of Jurassic Park and The Godfather, and obviously many other big movies you could mention. It's right there with Empire Strikes Back. People probably know what we're talking about when adjusted for inflation. What it comes down to is how many tickets did the movie sell? Because a modern movie costs so much money with the 3D showings and everything, and so many more human beings on the planet, so many more movie theaters on the planet. Mm-hmm. I'm not one of those people that says that the actual money means nothing. Because it does. A movie that makes $100 million now is still a big hit. It's not the biggest hit that would have been even, I don't know, 10 years ago. But it's still a monumental film. But one other success it had in that time, a very respected critic named Bosley Crowther, I don't think we've mentioned him too often on this project so far, he raved about it in the page of the New York Times. Mm-hmm. Other critics may not have been a big fan, but
he
was. It
had more good reviews than bad reviews, definitely. Mm-hmm.
And it won 11 Oscars, which was an awful lot of, well, it was the record at the time.
It was a record that was not broken until Titanic.
Well, Equal has never been broken.
That's right.
And the third movie that has won 11 Oscars so far?
Was Lord of the Rings, Return of the King.
Right. And as has been pointed out by people in some of these reviews, new reviews, because they can't refer to something that hasn't happened yet, that Return of the King and that Titanic had the advantage of having more categories. Makeup didn't exist back then, and other sound effects. Sound did, but sound effects didn't exist back in those days.
So it set records at the Oscars, and it was always second to Gone with the Wind in earnings and held that for a long time.
Yeah.
But it also set records. It had a $15 million plus budget, which was the largest ever at the time. It had the largest sets ever built. The numbers disagreed, but somewhere between 10,000 and 125,000 extras.
I read 15,000 extras. I don't think it was 125.
I only saw that in one thing. That sounds completely ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Even if you take the lowest, 10,000. Mm-hmm. That's an absurd amount of people to manage. They had the extras that were in the chariot race scene. They had the extras, all the soldiers, the centurions. Mm-hmm. They had the extras in Rome.
The Sermon on the Mount scene.
The Sermon on the Mount, yeah. It was a massive number of people. The shoot was very difficult. The crew worked 80 hours a week from May to January.
Mm-hmm. And 6 day weeks.
And 6 day weeks, that's right.
Wilder pretty much never stopped working, even on the day off on Sunday.
Yeah, that's right.
He would still be in meetings, of course. Yeah. So that's the way movies are today. Maybe not quite as powerful a schedule. But you don't really truly get a day off if you're the director, from what I understand.
But he did that for 8 months. Mm-hmm. And that's not counting pre-production and post-production. That's just when they were on set. And then MGM went on to spend almost $15 million just in marketing. It worked. We talked about how what a massive production Intolerance was. Mm-hmm. This dwarfs it. There's nothing like this.
Funny you mention Intolerance. That's, I think, the last time we saw Jesus on the project. It was our second movie.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
And it was briefly, but we saw the crucifixion scene. That's mm-hmm. the smallest part of the Intolerance 4 storylines, mm-hmm. is the Jesus storyline. So Jesus is back in the 57th movie after being in the second movie, making his triumphant return. I said a few minutes ago that the Monty Python stuff, mockable. Now, we didn't finish the point I wanted to make. We talked about the chariot race scene. But you had me cracking up, reminding me of that great line about the best of all the cheesemakers. I said that line, and you reminded me. What was the line you said again?
Oh, he's talking about the meek. Well, that's nice. I've had a hell of a time.
The meek shall inherit the earth. For the rest of the Sermon on the Mount scene, even though it's a very serious moment, and towards the end of the film, Judah's already been through so much, we were cracking each other up for probably 5 minutes.
Very respectful we are.
But that is Charlton Heston's style. He was an iconic film star. I wouldn't really say he was a great actor.
He has a great amount of screen charisma. You have to give him credit for that. And when it's a 3.5 hour film, and he carried it on his back the whole time.
I think I read somewhere that he was on screen longer than any other Oscar winner in history. He's in almost every scene. And when the movie's 3.5 hours long, I guess you're going to set that record there. But in Ten Commandments, the line I always remembered is he says something about how it's the glory of God. It's one of those lines I'll just randomly say whenever I see a Ten Commandments poster or an advertisement for it or on the IMDb or somewhere. The glory of God.
And well, he's always being Charlton Heston, right?
He is, yeah. And despite his fame as the head of the NRA and the "from my cold dead hands," mm-hmm. and the way that Michael Moore ravaged him in Bowling for Columbine about that in the interview at the end of the film, from all I've ever heard about the guy, he's been well-liked and well-respected in the business. And he doesn't come across as the monster from what I've ever heard or seen, except for that interview. And even in the interview, it's more a matter of ignorance than it is about him actually not caring about people. We've talked so much about Heston, we're going to talk some more about him, of course. But Stephen Boyd, his co-star in the film, I think has the second most screen time, and I would say he's the second most important character.
Yeah.
He didn't win the Oscar. Hugh Griffith, who we'll talk about soon, did. Boyd wasn't nominated at all. I think he was great as Masala.
Yeah.
And he's even got a great death scene. I think his scene was actually really well played. Is it over the top? Well, he's also been trampled by those horses, and he's either bleeding out, or he's not getting oxygen, or maybe it's a combination of those mm-hmm. two things and a lot more. But as so many people know, there's the homosexual subtext. Mm-hmm. Another movie, we talked about it the last couple of weeks. North by Northwest with the villains, Some Like It Hot with the cross-dressing, and then with Joe E. Brown being all over Jack Lemmon, even when he knows he's a man.
Mm-hmm.
And now here in Ben-Hur, we're going to get into Spartacus. I'm sure there are plenty of other movies we could talk about, too. Apparently what it was is that Gore Vidal, who's one of the uncredited screenwriters, now there's a controversial story.
Yes.
We'll get to that later. He said that he put that in there in a subtextual kind of way and told Stephen Boyd to play it as if you're a spurned lover. These two, probably as young boys, did that,
mm-hmm.
and then, for whatever reason, they're not doing it anymore, and Masala is angry about that. So when Masala comes in the movie in the beginning, he's a corrupt political figure who had previously been a friend of the hero, implied to be a lover. So Heston, who later on, when he heard the story, nope, that's not true, he was straight, wouldn't have believed it, and obviously Vidal is vindicated, mm-hmm. and the older
Apparently Wyler angry. Also was like, I don't remember anybody having conversations about that.
Maybe because we know this story is out there, and the writer claims that it's in the text. It seems pretty obvious. I mean,
they
link arms when they have a drink of wine. We didn't even do that at our wedding, and we were marrying each other.
Yeah, but I don't like you all that much. You tolerate me. Yeah.
It's for the sake of the podcast.
Yes, yeah.
And the dog, our two babies.
Yes.
But what did you think of that?
Oh, I totally think it's true.
Because if it isn't in there, then you just have friends who are against each other because Judah won't. Hey, here's some more blacklisting. We've talked a lot about that through the 50s films. That's been a subtext in a lot of them. Judah is blacklisted by Masala for not ratting on friends and not becoming an informant, essentially, on the Jewish rabble-rousers. I guess that would include Jesus.
Yeah. He's our hero, and he refuses to turn on his friends, and he pays for it with losing everything.
And Masala is looking for a way to mess him over, I guess, because I said in the nutshell, the shoddy roofing, that infamous early part of the film where the sister accidentally pushes some tiles off the roof and it injures the new, was he governor, I guess?
Yes.
And then it's, well, you're going to jail, Judah. You said you did it. You're going to jail for this, and you'll pay. But anyway, I think that either way, whether it's a homosexual subtext or not, it sets that up, as I said, so many of these other kinds of ancient movies do it, where somebody has done something to insult a former friend, colleague, and they got to come back and get their vengeance.
And there's more to it than even just that scene and the scenes as they're played together. You never see Missala have any interest in women whatsoever, even Ben-Hur's beautiful sister who's crazy about him. Mm. He's nice to her, but he doesn't even really flirt with her. We see him in other scenes when he meets Hugh Griffith's character. He's in a bathhouse. He's oiled up, wearing nothing but a teeny tiny towel, and surrounded by men. It's like Caligula in there. And all these things kind of play up to that notion that he's gay, Ben-Hur is bisexual, has opted to just do the traditional thing, mm-hmm. and Missala is left in the lurch, hoping he was coming home to this man that he was in love with, and getting spurned and overreacting.
And movies that don't really have any connection to Ben-Hur, you could even make a comparison with Brokeback Mountain. Heath Ledger's character would be Charlton Heston's,
yeah.
in comparison. That he wants this to happen, but he knows that there's a problem here, he's not going to let it happen. And in both movies, the main character lives, and the friend, the lover,
dies. Gets killed in a chariot race, yes.
Jake Gyllenhaal's character is a charioteer in Texas in the, whatever it is, the 80s or the 60s or the 50s or something. And one more thing I'll say about the subtext of the homosexuality is that it started off pretty early on when they meet up and they do this phallic spear-throwing thing.
Oh, yeah.
And then, of course, the spears are still sticking in the wall.
They're so in love in that scene. It's so obvious. You're kind of rooting for them to get together.
If they could have, maybe none of the things in the movie that happened would have happened. All right, so let's talk a little bit about the scene where he gets on the rowing boat, the slave ship, where he's paddling. That's the first time we see him with his shirt off, at least for an extended period of time, with a long beard and long hair, looking sort of Jesus-esque, I guess, going through this horrendous time for, I think it's supposed to be years.
3 years.
There you go. He meets Jack Hawkins' character. He becomes his father later on, his adopted father. Yeah. That is a centerpiece scene, about a third of the way in the movie, that's really well handled action scene-wise. You pointed out that there's miniatures, or were you asking me if there are miniatures?
I think I asked, because they're so well done. I mean, it's kind of obvious that they're miniatures, but they're incredible. They're just so rich with detail, and the movement is very well done.
And they do a good job of cutting between miniatures and what would have been just sets with the boats. And then when they get rammed, a couple of the guys have lost body parts, and apparently what that was, and Spielberg did this with Saving Private Ryan, you find people that actually are missing body parts, and then you make it up to look like they've just lost that hand or that foot or that leg or anything.
Well, of course, Wyler also directed Best Years of Our Lives.
With a guy who actually had no hands, sure. So for a movie that you could arguably call an action film, I don't think there's a lot of other action scenes you could really talk about. There are other moments of action, but then you get to, and let's talk about it now, the chariot race.
The chariot race. It took 5 weeks, spread over 3 months to shoot. There were 700 extras. It was shot first. I like this detail. It was shot first entirely with stunt doubles. Then they determined where they should reshoot particular shots with Boyd and Heston. The pageantry sequence, which I complained about earlier, was apparently a shot-by-shot remake of the same sequence from the 1925 silent version of this film. This is a remake, this film.
I have a trivia question for you. I'll get you off your mojo for a minute there. So this is the first remake to win the Best Picture Oscar. What was the second, and I believe the only other one to date?
Oh my gosh. What won the Oscar last year? No, 12 Years a Slave.
A remake of 6 Years a Slave. They up the ante.
Did I say 5 years is 12 years? They up the ante.
No, you said 12.
The sequel's going to be 13 years.
You said 12 Years a Slave, and I said 6 years was the original, so they up the ante by making 12 Years a Slave.
I give up.
The Departed.
Oh, of course.
Infernal Affairs, which we also own. We have both of those on the shelf. Mm-hmm.
Okay, back to me. So, aside from the pageantry, the parade, the rest of the sequence was directed by Andrew Martin and Yakima Kunut. Thank you. The arena at the time was the largest film set ever built. It covered 18 acres and cost $1 million alone.
Which would have been a big budget for any movie back then.
I know, that's crazy.
A single production, let alone one part of a production.
There was so much footage shot. The ratio was an astounding 263-1. So for every frame that wound up in that scene, which is a long scene, 263 that wound up on the cutting room floor. And that's insane. The average film, when we're talking shooting film, it's probably worse now with digital, but the average film has a ratio of about 8-1, that you shoot 8 feet of film for every foot that actually winds up in the final cut. That's an absurd amount of footage to shoot. The result is incomparable. I don't think there's a scene in cinema that can stand up to it. It has such an incredible kinetic energy. It's nail-biting. It's perfectly executed. It's long, but it goes by in a flash. It's so great.
There's so many reviews online that'll say it's the greatest action scene ever filmed. It's almost like they're parodying each other.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not so sure that it's the greatest. I haven't really thought about what would be greater. It's certainly on the short list.
Mm-hmm.
It is definitely thrilling and beautifully shot, with a convincing sense of danger.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons why it's a convincing sense of danger is because they actually had people put in danger. There's the scene where Judah has to jump over a fallen chariot and horses, I think both.
Mm-hmm.
The horses jump over and the chariot goes over too. That was a planned stunt, but it was Yakima Kanut's son who had to do it. Yeah. And he didn't listen to his father well enough and he didn't hang on properly. And that's why in the scene he goes flying out of the chariot and lands between the chariot and the horses. If he'd gone much further and landed underneath, he probably would have been killed.
Oh, yeah, that's
apparently
crazy.
The father thought his son just died. I don't know if they salvaged the shot after he landed, but that doesn't matter because they redid a close-up with Heston climbing back in, mm-hmm. a little cut on his chin. So a happy accident that was a very dangerous situation ended up working out great for them. It's one of the fantastic moments of the whole thing. Another thing they do really well is they show a sequence where they've got, I think it's two different guards. They're standing in front of that centerpiece thing, that island, because you'd call it an island, like
mm-hmm.
in a kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why they had that there was so they wouldn't have to show extras on the other side who have been there. You can't have those people there all the time in every shot. It would take forever to have those people in there. So anyway, you've got guards standing there. One of them is just standing. One of them makes a bit of a move. And then as the camera goes by, you see one out in the way and he gets kind of pulled into the action and trampled.
Mm-hmm.
And it's horrifying. But what it was just an articulated dummy. But they sell it by showing an actual person not getting trampled first. Because it's so fast, it looks almost like, they're, oh my god, they just trampled that guy.
Yeah.
And then Stephen Boyd in the scene where he ends up getting trampled by a horse that didn't get trampled, of course, but a lot of that stuff he did on his own. He was a pretty gutsy actor in his own right.
The dummies they used are really quite convincing.
For 1959, yeah.
Viscerally upsetting to see that stuff.
Yeah. And it's a very influential scene, too. We always talk about influence towards the end of the podcast. We've talked about The Simpsons, I think, on almost every podcast, and they've certainly referenced it a few times. The violence of the chariot race. It's supposed to just be simply a race, but of course Masala is cheating so badly. The only one that I ever see who does cheat. He's got the black horses, though, and Heston's got the white horses. That's not exactly subtle. The Lippensohner Stallions. I hadn't seen this movie in so long, I'd forgotten they were in there, and I always think of the Lippensohner Stallions referenced in Crimson Tide towards the end of that film, which is also a scene that's all about black versus white, and then this is pretty overt, too. The other recent movie that's pretty famous, despite all of its detractors, that certainly was influenced by the Ben-Hur chariot race would be Star Wars The Phantom Menace.
The pod race scene mm-hmm. is a pretty obvious homage to the chariot race.
And in some ways, it's a bit of a distraction from the story in both cases. People have pointed out that as great as the pod race is shot in Star Wars, and it does have relevance because he wins the race, he wins money and freedom and all that, so that needs to happen, but it's a bit of a contrivance that it even does. Same kind of deal here. Heston can't just walk in and kill Masala because they certainly would kill him.
Mm-hmm.
But you sell your differences in a sporting contest. If it was boxing, or like in Gladiator, where they literally face off at the end of the film. Spoiler alert on Gladiator. Who hasn't seen that movie by now, if you ever cared to. But at least those movies have that moment at the end. Braveheart's another movie that kind of jerks out your curtain from the true clash that never really happens.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the way that kind of stuff would happen. We've been watching Game of Thrones this entire season, the entire run of the show. Another TV show in this case that sort of jerks out the curtain from your expectations of what you'd expect with big clashes between two people who want to kill each other.
Mm-hmm.
So the chariot race is famous, it should be, it's great, it's all the things we've said about it, but if you think about it from a story standpoint, it's a little weird that that's how their differences are resolved. Maybe that's why Judah doesn't feel any real sense of satisfaction, because he didn't kill Masala, it was an accident, and Masala brought it on himself.
Yeah, what would he have done if he had won the race and Masala lived?
Good question.
He still need to seek vengeance?
I think so.
Hmm.
Okay, so we could talk about the chariot race for another 40 minutes, I'm sure. It's had us just doing this podcast.
Although if we wanted to follow the spirit of Wyler, we would talk about it for another 40 minutes before we moved on.
Longest podcast of all time. Well, this is our second longest movie so far. Gone with the Wind was 4 hours flat.
No one's going to beat Gone with the Wind for length.
But we do enter the stretch of epics now, most of the time, where they're really long movies.
I didn't get bored watching Gone with the Wind.
No,
but this movie is just mostly the end. That last hour is just tough.
All right, so the stars of the film, Charlton Heston is clearly the headlining guy. As I said, on screen constantly, I don't know if there's very many scenes where he's not. I think we've mentioned his other big films, Ten Commandments, Planet of the Apes, and of course can't forget about Touch of Evil with Orson Welles. That movie certainly could have made the list too. I don't think we've really talked about it all that much.
No, no, it's true.
That was the year before this. Janet Leigh, Heston, and Welles in a very fine film. We've talked a little bit lately about the icons of cinema because we just covered Marilyn Monroe and she was one you mentioned, the one you'd pick as the greatest movie star of all time. And I've mentioned John Wayne in the past and I'll say it again now. Do you think Heston, in that sense, not talent-wise, not is he a good actor, not is he a Brando, not is he Paul Newman, but do you think he ranks in there as far as representation of cinema?
He would be in the top 50.
Okay.
He would definitely deserve a mention, but I don't know, if especially if you include all the ages, including current time, he'd probably get elbowed out by some better actors and actresses.
Well, he was only ever nominated for one Oscar, and the only time he ever was nominated, he won, and that was for this film.
Yeah.
That was over Jack Lemmon for Some Like It Hot, by the way.
Oh, wow, he got nominated for that mm-hmm. role. That's interesting.
The more I think about it, the more that seems egregious. But if he was ever going to win, it should have been for this role.
They never reward comedy. They so rarely.
Mm.
Yeah.
Even so now.
That's understandable. Back then,
yeah. Mm. Typical for a huge production. There were many people up for it, but three names in particular stood out to me. I just mentioned Paul Newman. He was one of them. He had been in The Silver Chalice about 5 years before this, and he didn't want to do a movie again where it showed up his legs. Apparently, he didn't think they looked good in a tunic.
I'll be the judge of that.
Rock Hudson was up for it, too, and his problem, as Agent pointed out, the gay subtext.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
He had problems with that. He certainly wasn't out of the closet yet, and wouldn't be until many years later. And you mentioned Burt Lancaster was up for it, and I read his problem was that he was an atheist, and he didn't like the redemption of the Christianity story.
Oh, I'm really surprised to hear that. Not that he's an atheist, but mostly that an atheist would feel free to talk openly about that in the 50s.
Hmm. Seems unusual.
Mm-hmm.
I also read the debts of his production company would have been paid off by MGM if he'd done the role, and he still said no.
Wow.
Hmm. All right, his biggest co-star in the film would obviously be Stephen Boyd and their love-hate relationship. This is also his only AFI film. He was also in Fantastic Voyage and, appropriately, The Bible. I don't remember him in many other films. I don't remember him in those films. And I think I said this already, but Hugh Griffith, who we'll talk about in a second, was not nearly as worthy as he was. Griffith's role is not unimportant, but compared to the almost the co-lead, who's damn good in the movie.
He's just kind of a caricature.
Well, worthy or not, Hugh Griffith did win the Supporting Actor Oscar. This is also his only AFI as Sheik Ilderim. He was also in Exodus and Oliver. He doesn't do blackface, but he does do brownface.
Oh yeah, there's definitely some race appropriation going on.
Mm-hmm. Jack Hawkins, we talked about him off the top, his second of three AFI films. He's still going to be in Lawrence of Arabia, and he was in Bridge on the River Kwai. We never see him again after his last scene with Heston. He's got all the scenes in the water, and then he's got the scene back in Rome. Now, there's an interesting scene. The DVD documentary talks about how they shot that with miniatures and mats and all kinds of special effects. This mm-hmm. movie did win the Oscar for visual effects as well.
I wouldn't have earned it.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of Jack Hawkins? Going from being a slave driver to being somebody who accepts this Jewish guy as his adopted son.
He didn't blow me away. He wasn't bad. Didn't really impress me either.
And there may not be room for him in the story later on, but he is just flat out gone when he's
gone.
It also
wouldn't make sense for him to come back because he's in Rome. It's right. Very far away. In that respect, it's believable that once you leave a city, you don't talk to the people in that city anymore.
Distinct lack of cell phones in a movie like this. Haya Hararit is Esther, and mm-hmm. she's the freed slave who's in love with Heston's character. She only did a handful of movies in total, but she actually was Israeli, and that was fairly unusual for these kinds of movies, because mm-hmm. so often you've got English or American actors, sometimes Spanish or something else, playing characters from the biblical times, playing Middle Eastern people, but mm-hmm. here's somebody actually who was from the Middle East. And that's another thing about these kinds of movies, too. This was one of the many movies, I don't know if this started the trend, British actors played the Romans, and mm-hmm. the American accent, predominantly, not entirely, was for our heroic characters.
Yeah, he wanted the Romans to seem patrician, and British accents kind of call to mind imperialism, which is kind of what the Romans were. They were conquerors. They were imperialists. Mm-hmm.
Martha Scott plays Heston's mother in this film, and she also played Heston's mother in The Ten Commandments.
Oh my God.
It's a theme for her. Kathy O'Donnell, I mentioned her as one of the four people who's in more AFI films than Heston, and she was Wilma in Best Years of Our mm-hmm. Lives. And she plays the sister. And Claude Heater, I guess is how you say his name, spelled like heater. He plays Jesus, his only film performance ever, and we never see his face.
And he wasn't credited either.
Because he's Jesus.
Yeah.
They're going to imply that actually was Jesus coming down for a cameo.
Jesus works for MGM. You didn't know that?
He does, yeah. He also works for football teams and rock stars, rappers. And there are many other actors in the movie. Sam Jaffe plays a loyal slave and the guy who played Balthazar. But that's enough. We could spend 40 minutes talking about this
enormous cast. Yeah.
Yeah. We've said his name a little bit already, and here we'll say it again. The director, William Wyler. Last time for him on the AFI list, his third AFI film. He also did Wuthering Heights and The Best Years of Our Lives, which was 24 AFI movies ago. And he also directed Roman Holiday, Funny Girl, and The Big Country a few years before this with Charlton Heston. He had a huge amount of films. He worked a lot. He directed a lot of actors to Oscar nominations or even Oscar wins. He also is known as 100 Takes Willie.
Oh,
seems appropriate that there'd be a lot of takes in this movie. The 263-to-1 ratio you mm-hmm. talked about makes sense from William Wyler. He was an assistant director on the 1925 version of Ben-Hur.
No kidding.
Yeah, 34 years before he'd already worked on it.
He was not MGM's first choice. And in fact, I think a lot of people criticized him as a choice before and after the fact.
Wouldn't be the first time a movie of this type would have a director out of his element, as seemingly David Lean. A couple of movies ago, we talked about Prisoner of Rakwai. And then more recent times, people were surprised by some of the hirings for some of these tentpole movies. J.J. Abrams getting both Star Trek and Star Wars. Yeah,
even when like Nolan got Batman, everybody thought that was strange. It was it was a big stretch.
Mm-hmm. All right, here's an interesting and a controversial part of the movie, the writing credits. The actual credit on the movie was Carl Tunberg, not a name I know, but Gore Vidal, who we said already, and Christopher Fry are among the three or four uncredited writers. Gore Vidal very famously, and he's talked a lot about this movie over the years. He certainly wasn't happy with the way things went down. There's a long story about this, the writing credit, the arbitration through the Writers Guild, and everything that went on with that. If you want to find that, I'll go on Wikipedia when you're looking up Ben-Hur. But they all based on Lew Wallace's 1880 book. Obviously, the original movie was based on that too. General Lew Wallace. We said already about some of the things that Vidal threw in there. And there's a controversy about even what he supposedly wrote. He insists he wrote this. Tunberg didn't do that thing. And then someone else says, but he didn't do that. But anyway, that's something for people to read if they want to find out more. And the producer was Sam Zimbalist, his only AFI film. He also did Quo Vadis many years before this, another biblical-type film. Well, it was about Rome and Nero and all that, but biblical-ish. And we mentioned how hard Wyler worked. Well, he also took over producing duties when Zimbalist died during the production.
Oh, wow.
Apparently of stress from working on this movie. He wasn't that old. So Wyler produced a lot of it. The tech stuff. So this movie is, not surprisingly, 70 millimeter. And you mentioned the pageantry opening with all the horses going around the track once or twice.
Mm-hmm.
Overdone though it may be, that definitely does show off the 70 millimeter. And our TV may not be anywhere near the size of a movie screen, but at least we got to see it on a 42-inch screen and have this huge, vast scope in front of us for that scene in particular.
Yeah, the decision to shoot it on 70 was made by MGM and the cinematographer Robert L. Surtees. Wyler apparently strongly disliked it. He said, quote, "Nothing is out of the picture, and you can't fill it. You either have a lot of empty space, or you have two people talking and a flock of others surrounding them who have nothing to do with the scene. Your eye just wanders out of curiosity." Yeah. And apparently the cameras were enormous and heavy and hard to move and time-consuming and just kind of a pain in the neck and restrictive.
George Stevens had that opinion, too. We talked about it when he did Shane and Giant. Both of those movies were not the huge widescreen ratio. They formatted Shane to fit the widescreen theaters back in 1953. Mm-hmm. And Giant is not a 70mm production or anything like that, that grand, vast scope this movie has. So Wyler and Stevens, and probably many other directors of their era, had that same attitude. We're not going to shoot it that way. Although, interestingly, a lot of directors always shoot that way, even if it's not some big epic film. John Carpenter, Robert Altman, almost every film that they shot, that I'm aware of at least, was a 2-3-5-1. Ridley Scott shoots that way most of the time. Scorsese does now, generally. Now, we talked a little about the miniatures, the matte paintings, the cast of thousands, and all those people and all those technicians had to go over to many parts of the world, including to, I think I'm going to say this right, Cinecittà, over in Rome. Now, Fellini was known to shoot there. I think he's the one that made that place really famous. And apparently he was shooting a film around the same time. Mm-hmm. He was making his name around then, too. But they did shoot in the whole world, basically, for Ben-Hur. They went all over the place. You mentioned Surtees, the cinematographer. He also did The Graduate and The Last Picture Show. Nice diverse range of films there. Very different, all three of them. He also did one of the ones we've mentioned so often, The Bad and the Beautiful, not an AFI film. And The Sting, also not an AFI film. But they both could have been. And he won 3 Oscars in total, including for this picture. The editors, you mentioned them already and how much they didn't cut out. Probably wasn't their choice. John Dunning, Ralph Winters, and an uncredited Margaret Booth.
Apparently, the editor, one of the editors at least, fought very hard to cut down the ending, which I respected. Of course, I'm a butcher when I'm editing. He apparently strongly disagreed with their insistence on keeping all that leprosy stuff in and wanted to trim the fat and was overruled by Wyler.
Yeah.
The editing won an Oscar.
It did.
Well, then I shall reiterate the point I have made many times, which is it's criminal to give a movie an editing Oscar when its running time is 3.5 hours, period.
I agree with you on that one. The music, Miklos Rocha. He also did Double Indemnity for us way back when, a movie we certainly have liked more than a lot of the ones we've seen.
Mm-hmm.
He also did music for The Lost Weekend and Spellbound. He won many Oscars, but apparently he was the most proud of this one because of the different types of music he had to put in there and the biblical epic kind of stuff. This wasn't the first biblical movie, but it's definitely thought of as one of the benchmarks for it, along with the Ten Commandments, of course. We haven't yet talked about a stunt coordinator in the technical credits, and you already talked about him quite a bit, but Yakima Canut certainly had a big hand in the chariot race sequence. He was also involved in Spartacus, Gone with the Wind, Stagecoach, and hundreds of more movies, but 4 AFIers that I could find on that list. We talked a little about the influence already, but there's a few more things we will say. One is that there was a miniseries in 2010, which I did not see, and Mark Burnett of Survivor and many other TV shows fame is going to remake it for a 2016 release.
one of the things he's responsible for is, I think it was a miniseries, The Bible.
The one where the devil looked like Obama.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess that's why they decided to go ahead with this. If The Bible is any indication, then this remake of Ben-Hur is not going to have quite the production quality that this 1959 version of Ben-Hur had.
Yeah, it'd be tough to top, even though we're talking 50-plus years later. The Chariot Race influenced Phantom Menace, The Simpsons, and I'm sure there are homages in dozens of TV shows and other movies.
It probably has somehow influenced just about every action sequence. Certainly any race sequence from here on in would have had to be influenced
by it. Well, I didn't say any other action scenes I would say would top it, but a couple others that we mentioned would be the racing scenes in Bullet and French Connection.
Mm-hmm.
There was the original silent version in 1925. We talked about that plenty. And I think a pretty big influence is that it saved MGM from going under altogether.
Yeah, that's a good point. Without Ben-Hur, we wouldn't have had the entire James Bond franchise, maybe.
And now MGM is pretty much a non-entity again. They had a bit of a run about 10 or so years ago, and I don't believe that if they exist at all now, they don't exist close to what they used to. They were the studio for so long.
Yeah.
They weren't anymore by this point in 1959. We talked about MGM on so many of our movies in the early part of the project, and now we haven't really much at all lately.
Yeah, it's true. I guess they took big risks, and sometimes they paid off, sometimes they didn't.
The last time we talked about them must have been one of the musicals in the early 50s.
Mm-hmm.
The awards it won, so the 11 Oscars, which was record-setting, Best Picture, Best Director for Wyler, Best Actor for Heston, Best Supporting Actor for Griffith, the editing, Surtees cinematography, the sound, the sets, the costumes, the visual effects, and the music score for Rocha. The only thing it didn't win of its 12 nominations was Thunberg, Vidal, Fry, and whoever else, their screenplay.
Yeah, and it was rumored that the reason it didn't win for screenplay was because there was so much controversy over who deserved credit.
Because people had heard about it.
Mm-hmm.
Vidal or Wyler or someone had got public
mm-hmm.
about what was going on with the Writers Guild and the arbitration over the credit. Ben-Hur made the National Film Registry in 2004. Interestingly, the silent version made it in 97. 7 years
really?
Earlier. Yeah. And as for AFI lists, it was on 4 of them, apart from the main list. 56 in the top 100, Cheers, most inspiring. 49th in the top 100, Thrills. Might have thought it'd be a little higher than that. 21st, top 25 music scores, and 2nd in the epic category, the top 100 genres, number 1 on that. We're going to get to it in a couple of weeks, Lawrence of Arabia.
And I'll add that if the AFI ever release a list of the 100 best scenes, for sure the Chariot Race scene would be in the top 10, if not number 1 or 2.
Now, interestingly, you bring that up, because that's my next question for you. The movie dropped so much on the list, all the way down to 100. It barely stayed on. Do you think it deserved to be on the list? And if you do you think it should have dropped like that at all? Should have gone up? What?
I understand why it was on the list in the first place, but I would never have the passion for this film to advocate for it to stay on it. It's pretty flawed, and I can see how that could drive it off and make room for films that are less flawed.
But you can't forget about the criteria. Awards and cultural impact, the influence that it had on
its
film.
Vast popularity.
Those three things, the fact mm-hmm. it was a success, like you said. Those four factors, I guess, that's enough for me to make the movie absolutely an AFI film.
Yeah, I guess if you're judging by all of that and not just exclusively its merit, I think on merit, it doesn't deserve to be on the list. It deserves to be acknowledged for what it does do well. But top 100 American films of all time, I can certainly find some films to replace that.
You've said that a lot through the 50s, and we are now ending the 50s with this picture.
Yeah, I have not loved the 50s.
And I thought you loved the 50s, actually. Well, let's talk a little bit about the 50s as we end the decade. We did 21 movies, only A Place in the Sun and American in Paris, to me, were truly duds. You had others that you didn't like that much, and maybe you'd even call other ones duds. You weren't a big fan of films I thought you would be. On the Waterfront, which is, by the way, our most popular download on Podomatic.
Right.
It had an epic day not that long ago, and it's still number one by a mile, even though at the time it had been third or fourth last before that epic day. And you didn't love other movies I thought you might. You liked Shane more than I thought you would, which was nice.
Shane was my favorite film of the 50s.
The other ones I think would be disappointing or maybe not AFI worthy or something along those lines is an argument. You could make Giant and African Queen. I don't think they've aged that well is a big part of the problem with them. And Rebel Without a Cause is not great, and we made fun of it a little bit. But I think in the end, we sort of convinced ourselves that it was at least worthy of being talked about so much.
I think I gave it points for being gutsy in its subject matter and ultimately influential for that reason. It was a bit of a guilty pleasure, it felt like. I really enjoyed the experience of watching it.
Yeah, okay. So we started the decade with an intimate inside story about a few characters, Sansa, Boulevard.
Mm-hmm.
And we end with this massive cast of thousands epic Ben-Hur. What do you think off the top of your head was your favorite film from the decade of the 50s?
Oh, I already said it, Shane. It's definitely Shane.
Oh, okay, it is.
Yeah. Hands down.
Even more than All About Eve and
Twelve Angry Men in the 50s.
Prisoner of Kwai was on your shortlist, I thought.
I've seen All About Eve a few times, and I've only seen Shane once. They're tied. They're tied. I forgot about All About Eve. I love Bridge on the River Kwai a lot.
Singing in the Rain.
Oh, Singing in the Rain.
And for me,
too.
Sunset Boulevard, for certain. On the Waterfront, even though you weren't a big fan of Rear Window.
Of all these movies, Shane is the one that there was something moving about that film.
If you haven't heard our podcast about Shane, I think you should try to get it because we, I think, did a pretty good job with that one. And we surprised ourselves with some of the avenues we went down and how it affected me, especially in a way I'd never been affected by that film before.
It was just such a moving film, but I did love All About Eve. I think Shane wins simply because you can enjoy a film, but if it moves you, then that's going to push you over the edge. And that was the case with Shane.
All right. The last thing I want to say before we wrap is what I've been asking you a few times lately when we have multiple films from one year on the list. Three from 1959. As we end that year and as we end the decade, Some Like It Hot, North by Northwest, Ben-Hur. Ben-Hur wins all the Oscars. It's lower than the other two films on the list by a mile. Which would you have put highest of those three?
Some Like It Hot.
Yeah,
I just like that movie best of the three.
And from what I recall, you like Some Like It Hot and North by Northwest better than this.
Yeah, okay. It would go Some Like It Hot, North by Northwest, and then Ben-Hur. Do you agree? Or you would North by Northwest first?
Before we watched them, I would have probably had North by Northwest, then Some Like It Hot, then Ben-Hur.
Yeah.
But then if you go by the criteria what the AFI is looking for, it probably should be Ben-Hur, because of the things I said a few minutes ago.
Well, just for my personal opinion. Look, my personal opinion is almost as good as the AFI's opinion.
Well, if they ever do the show again, we'll definitely have to be two of the voters. We seem appropriate. Exactly. We've done all this work for them, promoting them. 56 times, 57 times.
We're not American, and that might hurt our chances.
And we have no credibility whatsoever. Except that we've done a weekly podcast that continues next week with something a little smaller, but it also won a bunch of Academy Awards of its own, our final Billy Wilder picture, and a huge change of pace, The Apartment. And the coming attractions trivia for The Apartment. Name at least 7 AFIers that are entirely, or at least primarily, set in New York, and also won the Best Picture Oscar.
Oh my god.
If I could do the work on that, so can other people.
The audience is going to have to do the work on listening to me list a bunch of movies and then pause to think a lot.
Luckily we can cut things out, as we always do.
Alright, so for the answer to that, please tune into next week's podcast, The Apartment. If you'd like more from Ryan and me, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. You can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. What did you think of Ben-Hur? Did you love it? Did you hate it? Did you agree with us? Please let us know. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is top100projectpodcast@gmail.com.
Blessed all the cheesemakers and the meek.
Oh, that's nice. They've had a hell of a toy. And cut.